Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room and Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Today we talk with science journalist Jennifer Ackerman about what drives our relationships with food. It's new science playing into ancient rhythms. Jennifer's book is Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream, A Day in the Life of Your Body. Sally Schneider, that master of cooking logic, takes all the intimidation out of the souffle. Natalie McLean tells how the worst job in the castle, tasting the king's food for poison, became a gig you can win awards for. Then we learn how to check out a fine French bread from the man who has made it his life's work. Professor Stephen Kaplan is called the world's preeminent French bread scholar. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's begin with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, you've been in one of my favorite states, West Virginia. What have you turned up?
We were in Moundsville, West Virginia, and we came across one of those restaurants that just sets our heart singing. It's called Hocut's Barbecue, and it has many, many things to recommend it. But one of the very best things on the menu is hush puppies. And I asked Travis Hocut to tell us about his hush puppies.
It's a recipe that my grandmother had for years and years and years. And it's a very simple recipe, and a lot of people ask me, hey, can you give me that recipe? And I tell them, if you eat it long enough, you'll eventually figure it out. I don't give nobody the recipe, and I don't let anybody do my cooking in my kitchen. If I'm not here and I can't cook, we ain't open.
This is a man after my own heart.
Don't you love that?
I love it.
You know, I could eat his hush puppies until I'm 150 years old, and I can tell you I could not figure out how to do them.
What do they taste like, though?
Okay, well, they're little cornmeal fritters. Almost,
well, they're
like
small.
Oval.
They're small hush puppies and kind of gnarled and oddly shaped. Like, they're probably equal amounts crunchy exterior and creamy interior.
Mm-hmm. And what's really kind of wonderful, and I have never seen this before, is he brings you a cup of molasses butter or honey butter or just warm butter. So you have three choices to dip them in. And the molasses butter is fabulous.
What a great idea that is, molasses butter.
And it's such a little, tiny, humble place. I mean, I have to just tell you, we went to Moundsville because, you know, we're connoisseurs of prison gift shops.
Yes,
and
yes, I remember this.
Now defunct West Virginia State Penitentiary, which is without a doubt the scariest looking building I've ever seen in my life. It's like a gothic haunted house, is right across from Hocut's Barbecue. So the fact that we found great food was just a lagniappe.
But you said there were many things to recommend the place.
Well, the very least is barbecue. I mean, it's right up there with the hush puppies. And even though we're in West Virginia, the man who owns this place is from North Carolina. So he serves this great peppery vinegar marinated pork butt with coleslaw on it.
And in fact, he makes a point of the fact that there is no barbecue sauce in his restaurant. You get the barbecue, it is already moist enough and flavored enough that he does not want you using any sauce on it.
Yeah. You know, it's not every day that Michael and I find a four-star barbecue that nobody has ever talked about or written about. And this is really the first that I think any of your listeners, unless they live in Moundsville, West Virginia, will probably have heard of this mm-hmm. place.
Oh, this sounds good. Hey, guys, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in with us here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Where some of us look for rigid rules in cooking, cookbook author Sally Schneider gives us the rules, but then encourages us to bend and play with them. So one recipe becomes many opportunities. And I have to tell you, nobody builds confidence the way Sally does. Sally's latest cookbook, appropriately enough, is The Improvisational Cook. Sally, welcome back.
Hi there, Lynn.
You know, you sent me this note with a list of thoughts of things you wanted to talk about, and one of them was souffle. And all I could think of was, A, she's on a revival kick because no cook has made a souffle since 1971, and or B, she's a masochist.
Well, honey, if you had my souffle or this recipe that I'm going to talk about, you would keep your mouth shut because let me tell you something. Soufflés, I think, haven't been done and aren't done generally because there's a big myth about them, about how terrifying they are and how easy it is to fail. But I know of nothing, Lynn, that gives a more spectacular, delicious presentation and gift to give someone. The people for whom I make soufflés never forget them. They're always talking about them with this kind of big, deep memory as though I had performed some kind of magic. And I make them all the time for myself. And I realized, you know, my brain works in funny ways. I tend to kind of make things into formulas. And I realized I had done that with a cheese souffle. And I had figured out the steps to do it. And I do them in under a half an hour to get the souffle ready. That's not much time for prepping something spectacular.
Step us through it.
Okay. What a souffle basically is a thick, flavorful paste that acts as a structure into which stiffly beaten egg whites are incorporated. And when you bake it, the egg whites expand and the whole mass rises way above the dish to create this dramatic kind of puff with a creamy interior. Now, once you understand the formula and a few tricks that you have to do, they're really easy to whip up. The first thing you do is make a cream sauce, which traditionally is butter, flour, and milk.
Right.
I leave out the butter, though.
Really?
That's my... Huh. Yeah, because I thought you can do it without the butter, and who needs more butter fat or milk fat into something that has a good amount of cheese, and you don't really taste it.
Good point.
So I just mix flour with cold milk to make a paste, and then put it on the heat, and it works perfectly. Then you throw some egg yolks in and seasonings like cayenne pepper and nutmeg and salt.
Right.
While it's cooling, you get your other parts of the souffle ready. You grate your cheese, you butter the dishes and coat them with Parmigiano, and that allows the mixture to climb up the sides of the dish so it rises high.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use a variety of cheeses. That's the beauty of it. I sort of make them with whatever I have around. The trick is the cheese should be pretty firm, sort of a medium-firm cheese like a Manchego. Gruyere is famous.
Right, so you don't want a creamy cheese and you don't want a brie or anything on that order.
No, you want it kind of pungent but not really sharp. I love sheep's milk cheeses and do soufflés frequently with them. And we're also going to do it with some Parmigiano or a very hard grating cheese that has a good amount of kick.
Mm-hmm.
So you've gotten all your parts ready. The final step is to beat the egg whites, and you fold the egg whites into the base with the cheese very quickly, put them in the dish, and throw them in the oven. And then it's a half an hour of quiet prayer. Not really. So here's what you need to know. The bowl and beaters or whisk, whichever you use that you're going to beat the egg whites in, have to be perfectly clean. So as a matter of course, I always wash them and dry them out and have them ready. Because fat, any little bit of fat will keep the egg whites from speed it from puffing up and whipping the way you need them to. So that's something you have to watch out for. You also cannot overbeat the egg whites. You need to beat them just until when you take the whisk or the beater out and hold it upright, the peak stands upright without falling over. No farther than that. So you need to, you know, be watching as you do it and test it a couple of times. And at that point, it's ready. And that's pretty much it.
And then when you fold it in, do you leave some white streaks in it, in the mix?
That's fine. Good point. You don't have to incorporate it perfectly. 8 or 9 strokes to fold it. Some egg whites will be fine. What you don't want to do is stir it together or mix it too much so the egg whites deflate.
Right, right.
But that being said, they're pretty sturdy. Soufflés really take quite a bit of abuse.
But there's this business about you tiptoe around the oven, you never open the door, you know, everybody whispers, don't drop anything.
Yeah. You know, I honestly don't know where that came from because you can open the door several times. I've banged things around. In fact, I took a souffle out of the oven, served it to a friend. She cut into it, said, "I like my eggs well done." And I went, you know, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
I put it back in the oven saying, "I don't know what's going to happen to this." 5 minutes later, it had puffed even higher.
Really?
Yeah, and it was even more fabulous than when I had taken it out. I have also baked soufflés in a cast iron skillet in the middle of the Appalachian Mountains using the barest of ingredients that I scrambled together, and it worked fine. So you don't have to have perfect soufflé dishes, although there is something wonderful about being served an individual soufflé in a classic French dish. But you can do them in anything, in any size. So the recipe that will be on the website will have amounts for 2 cups and 4 cups, and you can kind of go from there figuring out what will work in whatever size pan you have.
Dynamite. Sally, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook. Now, you can take on the souffle with Sally's basic cheese souffle recipe. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchens, our weekly attempt to make your midweek kitchen life a little simpler. You get a new recipe every week, along with shopping and technique tips. You can sign up for it for free at splendidtable.org. Oh, and one other thing. When you're on the site, be sure to look at our latest travel opportunity. We're hatching a plan to spend some time this summer in the Willamette Valley outside of Portland tasting wine. Now, details are still being worked out, but there's a place to sign up for more information. You know where you're going to find it? splendidtable.org. Coming up, loving food and your frontal lobe and tips from an undercover sommelier. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. Science journalist Jennifer Ackerman has tracked down the latest science in what makes us tick. And I'm not using tick loosely. According to Jennifer, we're a collection of internal clocks. And these timekeepers govern how we interact with foods, from hunger and appetite to even our obsessions. Jennifer's book is Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream, A Day in the Life of Your Body. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, Jennifer, we hear about how our natural body rhythms dictate things like, you know, when we sleep, dictate sex, dictate all kinds of things. But what about appetite?
Yes, well, we all experience these daily rhythms in many subtle aspects of our body functioning. And we think, you know, we know about sleep-wake patterns and we know about body temperature. But we do experience fluctuations in appetite as well. And our bodies are really run by our circadian clocks, our daily clocks. And we have a master clock in the brain, and we have small genetic clocks in our outlying tissues, in our liver, for example. And these circadian clocks work together to regulate the times that we feel hungry. And interestingly, the meals we eat in turn help to regulate our circadian clocks. This is why, for instance, if your body clock is out of joint from jet lag, it actually helps to try to eat 3 regular meals at the appropriate time of day in your new location. That helps get your body clock in sync with the little clocks in the periphery of your body, and also with the day-night cycle in your new location.
You know, there's another side to this, because you talk about something that I found really striking. The person who really loves food and frontal lobe lesions. Now, you've got to explain this. I thought this was so interesting.
This is one of my favorite stories in the book. Not long ago, 2 Swiss researchers were curious about what was going on in the brains of people who seemed to be obsessed with food. They had found 2 patients who had something that a benign eating disorder that they called gourmand syndrome. It's really like a food lover's syndrome.
They have a name for it now, I see. Okay.
Yes. And the syndrome was first identified by this team in these patients who had developed obsessions with food after suffering stroke damage in their right frontal lobes. And before their illnesses, both patients had kind of been average eaters, then they didn't have any particular food preferences. But after their illnesses, they became these passionate eaters. All they thought about was food, shopping for it, cooking for it, and especially eating it. And they craved precise exotic dishes. One patient said he wanted a scallop of game in cream sauce with spetzel, which I had to look up, and it turns out to be these egg noodles or dumplings I guess you find in southern Germany. But to follow up on their observations of these 2 particular patients, the Swiss researchers scanned the brains of 36 other passionate eaters with this gourmand syndrome, and they discovered that actually 34 of them had lesions in the same area, in this right frontal lobe. Now, I asked the scientists about this. They're quick to say that their findings don't really suggest that this little right-hand corner of the brain is our food contemplation area, or even the eating center of the brain, but really it's an area that's involved in obsessions of all sorts.
You talk about microbes and calories. Can you explain that?
Yes. Well, this was another very surprising fact that I learned in researching the book, that in terms of numbers, human cells are mostly microbes. By the time we're adults, we have something like 10 times more microbial cells than we have human cells.
Uh-huh.
So trillions of these little friendly microbes live in our intestines, and that's where they help to digest the food that our bodies can't digest on their own. And these are like complex sugars found in grains, fruits, and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some recent research that suggests that these little microbes may even regulate our fat storage and help determine our body weight. As part of the digestive process, the microbes break down nutrients to extract the calories that can then be stored as fat. And the microbe populations that each of us carry around in our intestines vary a little. So there's some evidence that the composition of the populations of microbes actually affect the number of calories we absorb from the food we eat and how many of these calories are transformed into fat. So the take-home message of this research is that the amount of calories available in the food you eat may not be fixed, but actually influenced by the nature of the microbes living in your gut.
What does overeating do? I mean, I'm thinking about you do holiday meals or something like that. What does overeating do to our rhythms?
Yeah, I had mentioned that eating affects our clocks. This new research suggests that overeating actually changes the core mechanism of the body clock, and it throws off the timing of our internal signals, including our appetite control. There was a study at Northwestern University to determine if food itself really could change the body clock, and the answer is yes, it can. The study found that animals who were fed a high-fat diet gained weight, and they started to eat at inappropriate times of day. The excess calories they were eating at times when they should have been resting. So for a human, that would be like, you know, raiding the refrigerator in the middle of the night and binging on junk food.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the book about the fact that we all share certain rhythms. And the book begins with waking up in the morning, and it takes us through a day. And when you come to dusk, you talk about how this is when the body clock actually changes its sense of time.
Yes. Now, this is actually another kind of clock in the brain called an interval timer. and it measures the passage of time from seconds to minutes and hours. And time of day actually affects this interval clock and our perception of the passage of time. So in the later afternoon and early evening is when our body temperature peaks. And so, too, our perception of the passage of time seems to slow a little at that time. To the interval timer in the brain, a minute in real time may actually feel several seconds longer. It's interesting, some drugs like marijuana and hashish have a similar effect. Mm-hmm. They cause this strange expansion of time. And actually, alcohol, on the other hand, if you have a glass of wine or gin, that tends to make time go more quickly. And it may be because it prevents the brain from receiving as many sensory inputs per second.
And it's interesting because, at least in the modern world, that's the time of day that often we have a drink.
Right. The time of day we choose to have our drink, cocktail hour, is also the time our bodies best tolerate alcohol. Nice coincidence. Time of day affects how quickly alcohol is metabolized by the body and also its effect on our faculties and our organs. So if you have a shot of vodka early in the day, heaven forbid, it's going to be more intoxicating than the same shot at twilight. And this has to do with our body temperature and also fluctuations in our levels of enzymes that occur over the course of a day.
Hmm. Well, Jennifer, I know we've barely scratched the surface, but thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Ackerman is author of Sex, Sleep, Eat, Drink, Dream, A Day in the Life of Your Body. What I like about Natalie McLean is she's a wine authority who approaches the subject in a very unintimidating way. She's racked up awards for her website, newsletter, book, articles. She's author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over, a wine-soaked journey from grape to glass. And she's always game for a new wine experience. Natalie, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
So you actually became a sommelier for one night. So what happened?
Well, I wanted to work as a sommelier one night in a fine French restaurant to really understand what a sommelier does, and then on the other side of the table, what we as diners should expect in terms of good wine service.
So what did you find out?
Well, I found out it's like driving in a car, and most of the time we're in the passenger seat, and we're going along, and the countryside is beautiful, and so on. But when you start driving that car, you realize all of the things that you need to be paying attention to, from, you know, who are you addressing at the table? How are you going to match all of their different meals with wine? What is their price range? And so on. It's a lot to think about.
How do you do that? This is what I'm thinking. I know one of my hesitations when I deal with a sommelier in a restaurant is I don't want to say that I don't want to spend $90 for a bottle of wine or $200 for a bottle of wine. And I don't want to be in a position where I have to do that. And I mean, does a sommelier have to? I mean, you must have to be sensitive to that.
Absolutely. You have to be a bit of a diplomat because, you know, people are also on dates, so they don't want to declare how much they want to pay for love or the person they're with.
Yeah.
So they do have to be very subtle. Sometimes that cue can come from the diner saying what he or she has enjoyed in the past. So if they name a particular bottle, then you're getting an idea of the price range. If they're not, though, there is a subtle way that you can do it. So you're at the you're behind usually or to the side of the person who's going to order the wine. Usually they've got the wine list tipped up in front of them.
Right.
And you can say something like, do you like something in this range? And you're pointing at the prices. So you get some secret communication going there without embarrassing the person.
How did you handle, well, I don't know, did you run into a situation where people, someone wanted to send a wine back or didn't like a wine?
Fortunately, I didn't that night, although I've had the experience myself in other restaurants. But, you know, I think there are ways of sending a bottle back, and it starts with, as a diner, asking the sommelier, I'm not sure about this wine. Do you want to take a taste and let me know what you think? And that's the cue to the sommelier to agree with the diner, whether or not the wine is faulty or not. The diner's obviously not pleased or not sure, and you can probe a little bit, but, you know, it's about making the customer happy and saying, you know, well, I'm not sure. This could be, you know, off. Would you like me to get you something else?
If someone has tasted a wine, the wine is perfectly fine. It's just they don't like that wine.
Mm.
And they ask, you know, they do send it back. Are they charged for it?
Another great question. It's another sensitive situation, too. I think that if the sommelier or server has recommended the bottle, then most definitely that bottle should be taken back, even if it's not faulty.
Uh-huh.
Because I think the server or the sommelier should probe enough to know the customer's tastes or what he or she is having for dinner, mm-hmm. is it going to compliment, and so mm-hmm. on. But let's say the diner has chosen the bottle. Well, to me, the restaurant is endorsing every bottle on that restaurant list, and it should still take the same kind of responsibility for making the customer happy. I think it's rarely the case where a customer sends bottle after bottle back,
right,
just to show
right.
off. I mean, it's
yeah,
embarrassing
yeah.
enough to send one back.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do believe in an all returns kind of policy.
So what are the other responsibilities of a sommelier?
Well,
what should we expect of a sommelier?
Well, I think that they should be there to heighten your dining experience, because I'm a big believer that wine with food is something that's much better than the two apart. And so the sommelier is there for that half of the equation. So the sommelier should be very knowledgeable about all the different wine-producing regions these days,
mm-hmm.
how those wines pair with food, what the chef's specialties are. And then they should also be able to read the customers, ask the right questions about preferences and price and so on. They really have to work as an integral part of the team these days. And in fact, a lot of sommeliers work hand-in-hand with the chefs to develop wine and food pairing menus.
So we should look at the sommelier not as someone that intimidates us, but somebody who's like a tool for us.
Exactly. And these days, I think the intimidation is going out of the role. You hear a lot of sommeliers now call themselves, you know, the wine dude or the wine gal.
Right.
So, you know, and they're knowledgeable. And they're just, I think, you know, I'm generalizing here, but I think more and more of these people are just sharing a passion for wine. And that's what it's about, not intimidation and snobbery.
Natalie, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Lynn. Cheers.
Natalie McLean is author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over, A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass. Bread baking pros who do not shake in their boots when they hear the name Stephen L. Kaplan are either in denial or living in blissful ignorance. Kaplan is the Goldwin Smith Professor of European History at Cornell University. More importantly, he's a bread critic. He's been described as the world's preeminent bread scholar. The French actually gave him the Legion of Honor for his work with French bread. Evidently, he sees bread as the epitome of both French history and culture. Now, we have Stephen Kaplan on the phone from Paris. Stephen, welcome.
Hi. Or should I say bonjour?
Bonjour. I think that works even better. Now, you've spent decades researching French bread. So what is the state of bread in France now, today?
Well, it was very bad until the early 1990s. It had declined from being the world's best bread in the 18th century to being a bread that was insipid, tasteless, badly made, and just generally unpleasant. And that was reflected in part in the vertiginous decline in per capita consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And since the 1990s, as a result of tremendous pressure from industrial competition that has forced artisans to rethink what they do, as a result of pressure from the mills, which are worried about losing market share, as a result of also a certain kind of demand that arose from consumers themselves, bread has, in fact, gotten a whole lot better.
Did its decline come from a change in how the bread was made and what went into it?
The major issue was that the French bakers forgot to worry about fermentation. And fermentation, especially floor fermentation, the first fermentation, mm-hmm. is the geyser of all flavor, of all aroma, of all taste. It's also the source of the physical chemical properties. We call them the rheological properties that dough has to have in order to withstand the ravages of being made into bread.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of this abandonment of fermentation, through mechanization and through heavy dependence upon industrial yeast and additives, the French simply began to produce very lousy bread.
And they weren't giving it enough time to rise in addition to the
ingredients? No, time is crucial here. I mean, that's the basic story. And there was all sorts of pressure, economic pressure, the pressure of expensive labor, the pressure of competition. And so they speeded up. And with the end of the Second World War and the sort of Americanization of one's worldview, mechanization being nirvana, the temptation was irresistible. You know, baking was also very rough. In the old days, Marx called bakers the white miners. White because they were covered in flour.
Yeah.
And they began working at 9, 10 o'clock the night before to produce the first batch full for the following morning. It was socially regressive. So partly the loss of taste was compensated by a greater humanity in the conditions of production. And now, as a result of rethinking the way in which machines need to be used, today we can do bread. Bakers can sleep 6-7 hours. They can use refrigeration fermentation, and they can produce bread that's really quite good.
Do you have a favorite bread right now in France?
Well, I have a favorite type of bread, and it's the closest we have in the bread making world to what we call appellation contrôlée in wine. That is to say, the famous wines of the terroir, like Bordeaux or specific Burgundies. This is the bread that's called the bread of French tradition, and it was, like many things in France where the presence of the state is tentacular and ponderous, it was mandated by the government. You can't call your bread a traditional bread unless it follows these rules, and there are simply two rules. A, no additives, and when you ban additives, you absolutely require a long first fermentation. You have no choice, otherwise you just can't make the bread.
Mm-hmm.
And the other stipulation was no freezing, which was meant to exclude par baking, which, from my perspective, is not an artisanal activity.
Is there one particular baker you're favoring at the moment?
If I were to tell you that and it were to echo back to France, where I rarely pay for my bread, wherever I go, I'd be in big trouble.
Okay, what about the United States?
We're getting better because we're developing a certain consciousness of and a certain fascination for well-done bread. So we see niche bakeries beginning to pop up here and there. It's still, by and large, a wasteland, but I think that there are very positive signs. I meet an awful lot of young American bakers, many women, and I'm pleased to say that because the bake shop and the bakery in France is heavily gendered male, and it's an unpleasant environment for women. I see millers are beginning to emerge who are producing bread either on stone or without additives, And I think the result of this is that we're going to be better and better, although it's still going to remain a very segmented market where I think the bulk of Americans are going to be recalcitrant about paying more and changing their habits.
Well, Stephen, thanks for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Professor Stephen L. Kaplan's forthcoming book is The Return of Good Bread. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the special relationship that England has with the fork? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. Get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. You can find handcrafted, American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the special relationship that England has with the fork? Well, England was one of the last holdouts in accepting the fork. Supposedly, it didn't arrive until the beginning of the 1600s, and then it was snubbed as being Italian. Therefore, useless, effete, and putting on airs. The Italians had been dabbling with the fork, well, since the late 1400s. The earliest ones had only two prongs, and they weren't used as much for eating. Well, you did eat candied fruits with them, but mainly they were used for getting the food from the platter to your plate. Now, at that time in England and Northern Europe, spoons were the big thing. You gave a fancy set of spoons to a new baby, to even pallbearers at a funeral. And in Wales and Holland, the bride-to-be was given a spoon when she announced her engagement. And this supposedly is where the term spooning came from, meaning making love. But I digress. By the 1700s, the fork was being used the way we use it today. The British had relented. It wasn't so fancy after all. But the latest hot number in England is a new mutation of the fork, and it blurs its form. It's called the nork, and it is a knife and fork in one piece. Trust me, a line has been drawn in the sand. Some people love its modern convenience, just one instrument to haul to the TV tray, and others are outraged at this sign that civilization is coming to an end. Interestingly, an American designed the nork, and there's not been a ripple of controversy here.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's
it is time for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have Mark from Homestead, Iowa. Hey, Mark, good to talk to you. What do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I wanted to ask about the preparation of venison heart and what we might do for some different recipes.
Do you know you are probably one of the 10 people left in the United States who has any interest in eating heart?
I figure there might be one or two out there.
Yeah, this is such an interesting thing because organ meats have gone, I mean, just down the tubes in this country. And it
sure.
used to be people ate everything because it was economical and it was really tasty. The deal, I was raised eating heart. I'm mm-hmm. not saying I loved it, but then I finally had it made by someone from, as I remember, Peru, somewhere in South America, and I was blown away.
Wow.
You know what heart does. It pumps. So it's a tough muscle. And let me ask you something. I mean, do you want something where the taste of the heart is going to really sing through? Or do you
want... I mean, when my hunting buddy last year, Doug, served it up, I was surprised that the flavor was much milder than what I expected.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was quite good, and it didn't seem like there was any reason to kind of mask the gamey flavor that, you know, people complain about.
This is what I would do. The thing with heart is it's a very chewy muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways you can do it is to give it a light marinade, and you could do a little red wine, a little olive oil, a little bit of garlic.
Okay.
And don't do that for a long, long time. Do it for a couple of hours in the refrigerator. And slice the heart thinly. Remove anything that looks like tough membrane.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then, well, if you slice it thinly, come to think of it, and you do that light marinade, you know, you could just do a quick pan sear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if it's thin enough, you can just do, get it just very, very hot, little bit of olive oil, some coarse salt on it, in and out of the pan very quick.
Okay.
And that'll make it tender.
Mm-hmm.
Then the flip side of that is to have it in larger pieces.
Okay.
Brown it on all sides. Throw some onion in the pan. Throw maybe a little bit of thyme.
Okay.
And the marinade itself, and just let it simmer really, really gently for maybe 45 minutes, an hour, until it's quite tender.
Okay.
And that would be the other way that you would do it.
Sure, that would be great in our cast iron skillet on the wood stove.
It would be out of this world. No, but you know what it's like? It's just like veal scallopini.
Okay.
Or it's like squid. You either cook it really fast or you cook it really slow.
Okay.
But nothing in between.
Great.
Enjoy.
All right. Thanks very much.
You take care, Mark. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. Who's up next? Now we have DJ from Cincinnati. DJ, what do you want to talk about?
Hello. I'd like to talk about a gift my husband received from a person visiting from France.
Uh-huh.
And it is a can of Confit du Canard du Sud-Ouest, which is a Southwest. I don't think that matters so much. But I believe it has something that says deux cuisses on it, which is probably two thighs.
Yeah.
What do I do with it? I mean, I did look in a cookbook.
Uh-huh.
And the only thing I found similar was goose confit, and I didn't really want to make a cassoulet, which is a lot of work.
Yes, it is, but I have to tell you, this, what you have is a confit of duck, and the sud-ouest is the southwest of France, which is confit central, for lack of a better word. And this is a very old way of preserving duck and goose. And what is done is that the animal is cut up, and it's salted and seasoned overnight, and then it's cooked in its own fat. Mm-hmm. And then it's stored in its own fat. And it can keep for a very long time. And you have got a commercial version of that.
Yes, I'm sure.
And all you have, first of all, you're going to have fabulous duck fat. That mm-hmm. will be one of the great cooking mediums you will ever know in your life. A great, you know, treat for the occasional treat. But what you do with the confit, you can make a cassoulet, sure. But what a lot of people do is they just eat it. So you take it out of the fat, you know, scrape as much as you can off of it. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you put it in a skillet and you slowly heat it up and you get the skin crisp. It's going to give off some fat. But the reality is, surprisingly enough, in this whole cooking process, even though this is buried in fat, a lot of the fat is cooked off from under the skin. So you can get a crisp skin. Do it on both sides. And the other thing you can do, and you can start doing this and then hold them warm and then just heat up those thighs, is you can thin slice potatoes and pan fry them in the fat.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
It is fabulous. Finish it off with a few thin slices of garlic toward the end of cooking. You don't want to put it in at the beginning. It'll burn. Mm-hmm. But just get them really crisp and crunchy. Put them on a plate. Have a salad of really tart greens with a simple oil and vinegar dressing, you know, something like curly endive or frisée, because mm-hmm. you want that kind of tart snap against the richness of the potato and then the thigh. And then just put the thighs in a skillet, medium heat, heat them all up on one side, flip them over, get that skin crisped up. You will be so happy. It's a glorious gift for somebody to give.
Well, thank you so much.
You
That's
are welcome.
Help.
Oh, what a treat.
I'm so glad I called you.
Hey, you take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I cannot tell you the memories that that brings back. Oh. At any rate, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have got Catherine calling from Memphis. Catherine, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm embarrassed, actually, Linda, to call with such a simple question, but I am a new mother, and so I'm looking for easy recipes to do in a crock pot.
You may be a new mother. Do you know how many people are out there, either they're new mothers, new fathers, working or whatever, have the same kind of question? It's not a simple question. It's called life. Okay, so you want to know what can you just kind of throw in the pot without a lot of work, right, and just have it cooking away during the day while you're busy.
Exactly. And I'm looking for flavors that are really robust, because I've done a couple of crock pot recipes, and they've just haven't turned out well.
Yeah, and usually it's a case of if you up the seasoning, you will like it a lot better. Well, first of all, almost any stew or curry can go in the stock pot. And one of the things I like about a lot of curries is that you don't have to brown the meat first, which is messy and time-consuming, and you need to do that in a skillet.
Okay.
So here's the deal. A ton of sliced onions and thin sliced garlic, okay? Some fresh coriander, if you like coriander. All right. And then you can make essentially do your own curry, which would be throw into a food processor or by hand, chop up about 2 inches of fresh ginger with about 4 cloves of garlic.
Okay.
You want some cumin, okay. Ground cumin.
Mm-hmm. Cumin.
Yeah. I mean, what could be bad, right? You can throw a couple of chilies in there, you know,
okay.
Fresh chilies or dried chili powder. Then you want to add maybe a little turmeric.
Okay.
Allspice or cinnamon. Black pepper and some salt.
Okay.
And put that in with some oil, just a flavorless vegetable oil, something like canola or whatever.
Okay.
Put the crock pot on high and let that cook uncovered for maybe 15, 20 minutes. Stir it when you think of it. Mm-hmm. Then you could have on the side cut up bone chicken thigh or pieces of lamb or chunks of stewing beef. You follow what I'm saying? I mean, it's almost anything that's going to be a little on the chewy side that needs to be cooked for a while.
Okay.
Throw that in with a bit of tomato. And if you can get it, a can of coconut milk would not hurt.
That'd be delicious.
Yeah, it really would be. But if you don't have the coconut milk, you can add broth or half broth and half coconut milk. You want to cover everything.
Okay.
Set it on low and just let it cook for several hours. And that'll reheat. If you put it in the fridge, you can make a big batch of it, stick it in the freezer, serve it with rice. And by the way, the easiest way to do rice, the most forgiving way to do rice, is cook it just like pasta.
Really?
Yes. We just finished a book that's coming out called How to Eat Supper, coming out in the spring. And the show's producer, Sally Swift, came up with this, and it was brilliant. Sally just drops the rice in a big pot of boiling salted water. And you boil, and you taste. And it takes usually about 5 minutes. You drain it. You want to drain it when it's a little underdone, because it'll sit there in a sieve finishing cooking. And that's your rice.
Does that work for jasmine rice?
Any rice that has ever been grown. And by the way, the same thing is true of cooking something like barley.
Oh.
Barley takes longer. The rice can take 5 minutes. Just watch it and taste it. But you don't have to worry about sticking. You don't have to worry about burning. You don't have to worry about anything.
That's very good to know.
But you can follow that same basic formula that I gave you for the curry. Change the seasonings. Maybe eliminate the ginger and the chili. Use instead maybe garlic and some sausage and that kind of thing. Add the broth or add wine, and you have an Italian kind of meal. Do you see what I'm saying? The premise is always the same.
Right, right. Okay.
And don't hesitate to up those seasonings to your taste.
Okay, perfect. Then one quick question.
Sure.
So many slow cookbooks out there.
Yeah.
Do you have one that you'd recommend?
I would say anything by Molly Stevens is worth looking at. And
okay.
Then there is another book, and it's by a couple, and their names have just dropped out of my brain. They're in Cleveland, and it's, I think, called One Pot Cooking.
Okay.
And it came out quite a while ago. It's on our website.
Okay.
I know that. And boy, their recipes are dynamite.
Oh, wonderful.
They really are. But Molly, if you see Molly Stevens' name on recipes, she's dynamite also.
Okay.
Let me know how it turns out. Give us a call back.
Thanks so much, Lynn. I appreciate the tip.
And congratulations on the baby.
Oh, thank you.
You take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. Remember, you can reach us anytime, day or night, 800-537-5252. If you're on the North Carolina coast and you're not sure that a seafood restaurant really has fresh local oysters, check behind it. There should be mountains of oyster shells. Oysters are a big local deal in the Carolinas. Now someone's figured out what to do with those shells beyond paving sidewalks. We have Sabrina Varnum on the line. Now, she is from the North Carolina Department of Environment and Natural Resources, the Division of Marine Fisheries. Sabrina, welcome.
Thank you.
So what are you guys doing with all the oyster shells?
Well, what we do is we have sites set up for the public and also our high-volume facilities like restaurants. We provide places or containers for them to recycle their oyster shells, and then we take those and put them out back into the water to create habitat for more oysters to grow.
Is it like building a reef for the oysters?
Exactly. Oyster studies have been conducted, and oysters prefer to attach and grow on one another when you're out there in the water and you see them growing in clumps on one another.
Right.
They prefer that, and it's the preferred substrate. So we're trying to rebuild the oyster population since it's been in decline. And also, oysters are an important aspect in estuary because they're filter feeders, so they improve water quality, which is a big issue on the coast here. And then the reefs naturally form a community. So a lot of popular commercial recreational fin fish, mm-hmm. as well as crustaceans like shrimp and crab, live around these. So they form communities, too, from their habitat.
So is the decline in the oyster population, has it been because of pollution and problems of that sort?
Pollution is one of the causes, but it's not the only factor. Harvest pressures, diseases, pollution, and water quality.
Uh-huh. So this sounds like you're actually setting up an entire filtering system.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
Thank you. Because I think that unless people have seen this, I mean, every place you go where oysters are served, there are literally mountains of these shells. And so you've got an awful lot to work with. And, of course, it keeps coming, doesn't it?
Yeah. Participation from restaurants is growing tremendously. The program was first started in the fall of 2003,
mm-hmm.
and majority of the shells we were getting were from festivals, you know, like Big Giant, the North Carolina Oyster Festival. But now it's grown so much in the awareness that not only are we getting a lot of shells from the public, but the restaurants have grown. And between the restaurant and the shucking house, they're our largest contributors to the program. And so this is a way to recover the shells from having them being lost to driveways or landscaping or construction companies or other states with similar recycling program, and doing something locally, you know, along here on the water by giving us your sales, which then in turn provide habitat for more oysters, which then instant karma, more oysters for your restaurant.
It sounds like I'm going to have to come down and just eat a lot of oysters to contribute to the effort. Thanks so much for talking with us, Sabrina.
Thank you.
Sabrina Varnum is with the North Carolina Department of the Environment and Natural Resources, the Division of Marine Fisheries. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Mark Twain. Now, this is what he said about fellow writer Bret Hart, who was a bestseller in Twain's day. Twain said, "He hasn't any more passion for his country than an oyster has for its bed. In fact, not so much. And I apologize to the oyster." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room and Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed to last for years to come. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in the home at roomandboard.com. Information about nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our splendidtable.org website. Now, while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, devoted to making your weeknight kitchen life a little easier. It's free, so sign up, well, you know where, splendidtable.org. And just in case you miss us one week, you will find free podcasts of our entire program at that very same website, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical whiz is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.